From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel. It's good to have you back.
Yes, agreed. They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul Deccant. Most importantly, you are here. You are you. That makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, Cryptocurrencies Part 2. I just followed through with that because it rhymed. It had a bit of a flow. But we are not alone today. No, we are joined again with our longtime friend slash nemesis of the show, recurring guest who I think may have been on, guest with the most appearances on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
Yeah, we've got a jacket for you, a la SNL. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. We get to go to the...
Join the Five Times Club.
Well, yeah.
You exactly. Get to meet Steve Martin, but excellent. You have to also meet Chevy Chase. Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Strickland.
Hey, and just like love, I was inside you all along.
Ugh. What?
Yeah, it's gestating.
I've been meaning to get that checked out.
Sorry, yeah.
Are you doing a reference?
What?
So Jonathan, thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. In our previous episode, we discussed the nuts and bolts of cryptocurrency.
Yeah, and blockchain technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we agree would probably be the best move for you listeners, friends, and neighbors. If you are not familiar with cryptocurrency, please check out episode 1 before you go to this episode, because we're gonna cut past that. We're gonna cut past that blockchain jive.
Sure.
Yeah. And on other past episodes, we've discussed some of the darker sides of what cryptocurrency might be, and you're here to really shine a light in some of that darkness. Let's see what's real, what's not.
Yeah, I'm happy to at least to impart to you what I know. And I wholly admit there are things I do not know, but I don't know what those are. So here we are.
You got unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
So for a peek behind the curtain several weeks ago, Matt, Noel, and I began talking about doing something on cryptocurrency conspiracies. And I think a lot, Noel, you had come with this idea, and I think a lot of it was inspired by conversations we'd all been having both together and as individuals about speculation and booms and busts in cryptocurrency and the proliferation of non-Bitcoin cryptocurrency. And one of the things that we wanted to do with this episode is get your take on some of the allegations that Matt has mentioned about different, well, rumors,
sure,
allegations, perhaps stereotypes of cryptocurrency. The first one, which is probably the most apparent and something I think you've probably remarked upon in tech stuff as well, which is one of Jonathan's other podcasts available wherever you find your favorite shows. One of those topics is cryptocurrency and crime. So how much truth is there to the characterization of cryptocurrency as like a cash for criminals?
So there's certainly some legitimacy to that, in the sense that the very nature of cryptocurrency allows you to make somewhat anonymous transactions. If you are super, super deductive and you are really paying attention to patterns and you're really tracking which accounts are getting transfers at what time, you could probably draw some conclusions that could narrow you down to a specific person. But generally speaking, these are anonymous, right? So it's an ideal currency for someone who wants to purchase something that otherwise would be illegal, because it's not easily going to be tied to that person.
When it's a currency that's used a lot on like the dark web and like,
sure,
buying drugs or the illegal firearms, anything like that, right?
Yeah, the Silk Road, which was, you know, one of the many black markets on the dark web, which has been shut down and opened up again and shut down repeatedly. That was one of the places known for accepting Bitcoin currency from pretty much the start of Bitcoin, once it really got its got going. So a lot of people immediately began to associate Bitcoin with this concept of the currency you want to use when you want to do something illegal, whether that might be purchasing drugs or weapons or paying someone to do something terrible to someone else. All of those were allegations.
Like pranking them or something?
More
assassinating.
Pranking to death. Yes, pranking to death.
He's been pranked to death.
Yeah, it was a lethal banana pie to the face, except way more violent and splatty.
So is this like Law and Order Carrot Top?
Yes, okay. It's or Gallagher. Yeah, it was hit by the watermelon smashing mallet. So seriously, though, that was certainly an element. And it very quickly got this reputation in those early days, and it's somewhat earned, not entirely. I would argue that Bitcoin kind of falls victim to the same thing that peer-to-peer networks fall victim to, which is that both technologies can have their uses in illegal activities, but that wasn't necessarily what they were made to do. Peer-to-peer networks were created so that it would be easy to distribute files quickly across a network, big files. And that doesn't necessarily mean something like a movie that you don't have the rights to. It might be something that you can freely distribute. It's just that to do so in normal means would take too long.
Right. It's just a efficient way of transferring files over the internet that doesn't require a one-to-one transfer of a single file. It's just a little bit more efficient and makes better use of the pipeline.
And blockchain technology in general is a great way of keeping record of transactions because every single transaction becomes part of that shared ledger. It's part of that shared history, and it's there forever, right? So you can track ownership through blockchain technology if you want. So, for example, if you wanted to use blockchain to keep a record of real estate deals, you would definitely know who owned that, or at least what account owned that last real estate deal, owned that parcel of real estate, because it would be in that shared ledger. There'd be no getting around it. In fact, a lot of people have talked about using blockchain for stuff beyond just cryptocurrencies. So there are legitimate uses for it, but it's hard to escape that reputation once you get it. Certainly, there are still people who are using Bitcoin to do stuff that is extra legal.
Okay. So then if we were to say on the validity of this on a scale of 1 to 10, it sounds like it's about a 5 or a 6.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly something that has been an issue. And, people who wanted to commit any kind of criminal act, whether it was purchasing something or paying someone to do something certainly, Bitcoin would be an attractive alternative to using a currency that could be traced back to you. Really, it's not the currency so much that's traced back to you. It's the transaction itself, right? Because often these transactions have to pass through a third party. It's that third party that is the barrier for a lot of people.
Isn't this the thing, though, where, like, you know, with Facebook, you're constantly having to accept updated terms of service and things like that? Obviously, using something like Bitcoin or being part of one of these exchanges, there's no such protection. So who are we to say that, you know, all of a sudden that anonymity goes out the window or something fundamentally changes about the way business is done?
I mean, it all depends on how you've set up your wallet. Right. Like if you've got your wallet with an exchange, then there are a lot of dangers there. There's the danger that your identity may never be revealed, but someone might get hold of your money. So it's a complicated affair. But that's the case with any kind of currency or commodity. I mean, there's always going to be some element of risk there because there's no such thing as a perfect system. Systems are being made by human beings, and so far we have not created the perfect human being.
Well, the most popular wallet is Coinbase, I believe, and they've been having they were having some troubles, I believe, earlier this year.
Every single one of these digital wallet companies have had some sort of issue. Sometimes they've been relatively minor, like people reporting that they suddenly could not access their wallets for a given amount of time. Other times it gets way worse, where people can't access their wallets and they find out 2 weeks later the reason is all that information was stolen.
And it's because it's a unique thing, it can be stolen, to meaning that it's not. So like if you're quote unquote stealing a movie by, you know, downloading it through a peer-to-peer thing, you're getting a copy of it. You're not physically taking it, but in this case,
the original still exists.
Right, but in this case, the original is no longer accessible.
Well, it's because what you have stolen is you have stolen the end point of the last transaction for that Bitcoin, right? Or that part of a Bitcoin, depending upon how much was being spent. So what you're effectively stealing is the destination that Bitcoin went to. So again, Bitcoins do not exist in any sort of physical reality, right? What you're doing is you've got a record of transactions. And in fact, this isn't that hard to imagine if you've dealt with money on any digital scale, like just regular cash, dollars. If you do a transfer from your bank account to some other account, they're not sending suitcases filled with bills. They're wiring over a notification saying this transfer has taken place. This represents this amount of wealth going to this person. Same thing with Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have done if you've stolen is that you've stolen that account saying, you now own the wallet where it says this is where those Bitcoins went last. And because most people are using Bitcoin anonymously, it gets really hard to say, well, that specific one doesn't belong to you. It gets real muddy.
Speaking of anonymity here,
one thing
that we discussed in a previous episode was the identity or identities of the enigmatic
Satoshi Nakamoto?
Yeah, pioneer of Bitcoin. We also found some pretty interesting allegations or pretty interesting arguments that Bitcoin, some people believe, may be a tool of intelligence agencies or state actors. Have you heard this?
Interesting. I had not specifically heard that. It's very interesting because the at least the stated purpose for Bitcoin is so antithetical to that. But then you could argue, well, that's the perfect cover, right? The idea that, if I go out there and tell everyone this is the perfect currency to adopt because it doesn't involve a state actor, it doesn't have any third party, it's all direct transfers between people within the system, and therefore no one needs to know apart from the two parties involved, except for the fact that, of course, every single transaction becomes part of this shared ledger.
Kind of a
Matt,
financial
would that be like for off the books, like Black Ops and things like that? Is that the idea here?
Yeah. Well, it all originates from this person, Natalia Kaspersky. She was giving a lecture at a university in St. Petersburg. And, you know, somebody snapped photos, as you tend to do sometimes, of the slides as she was giving the presentation.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was discussing Bitcoin in particular. And this is just a quote that was taken from this. It was in Russian, or it was not written in English. This is a translation. But it was, "Bitcoin is a project of American intelligence agencies, which was designed to provide quick funding for U.S., British, and Canadian intelligence activities in different countries." So the idea that you could wire money, essentially not untraceable, but you could wire money easily that is not in the currency of some other country, depending on where you're transferring it to. It doesn't need to be exchanged at all.
Creates plausible deniability that if, like, saying, these actors who, for example, snuck into an Iranian nuclear facility and installed viral software upon centrifuges, they weren't paid in any country's currency, so therefore it's harder to trace back. Something like that?
Yeah. And it's also interesting. So that would be really good cover for that kind of thing. And then also if you're having a very large transaction to maybe another intelligence agency or someone you're working in tandem with, you don't have to exchange, you know, a huge transaction anywhere. It's only a couple of Bitcoins, really, or, you know, 100 Bitcoins here, and you're like, that's a massive transaction.
Like the example I heard would be the CIA interacting with ISI to support something that would technically be U.S. support of known terror groups.
Sure. So that, yeah, kind of also like when you get into past scandals like the Iran-Contra, that sort of stuff. Well, let me say this. It wouldn't surprise me if there were various agencies, intelligence agencies, making use of cryptocurrencies for this sort of thing. I don't think they would have had a hand in creating them necessarily, but I certainly wouldn't find it surprising to hear about them leveraging it. You got to remember that ultimately, in order to get units of that currency in the first place, you either have to mine it, which means assuming your system is on the up and up, you have to dedicate a lot of computing power to that. and knowing that once that secret is out, you know, once everyone knows, and you know, the system depends upon everyone knowing, once everyone knows how the mining process works, there are going to be lots of people working very hard to be really good at that because that's how they earn money. Or you've got to actually exchange real-world money for those units of currency, right? So ultimately, if you get to a point where someone is exchanging large amounts of their current currency, their state-sponsored currency, for Bitcoin, that could be traceable. So you really, all you've done is shifted things.
How could it be traceable, though?
Because you're actually going to have a budget item somewhere under someone's budget saying, this X amount of money was spent from our budget.
Not if it's a black budget.
It's classified, Jonathan. Come on.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that it's not written down somewhere, buddy.
Oh. Sometimes it does, though.
I would think so. And all I'm saying, too, is like, you know, in the same vein, sure as hell feels like a good way to launder money.
Oh, sure. No, that's another element of the criminal aspect is the idea of using Bitcoin to launder money.
With way more effective than a car wash. Also, you got to wonder what the rates are, you know. Is it 15%? Is it 20%? And then, like, at what point should you just pay taxes on it?
Yeah.
So, and are these criminals and or the government, do you have to use a thing like Coinbase? Or is there another entryway into this?
I mean, you can have
system?
A wallet on your hard drive. That's why when people have their hard drives and they lose them and they're like, I lost $700 million on my hard drive, that can happen.
So we're going to follow up with more of this conversation after a word from our sponsors, assuming we don't get blackbagged. Holy smokes! We made it!
Noel stole my bit.
I thought if we all did it, we just all had black bags on our heads.
We could do it again.
No. I think we're good. Let's keep going.
I have four black bags in my bag at all times.
I'm not at all surprised by that. And yet still terrified.
Look, it's like somebody using Bitcoin. Just because I have that doesn't mean I'm a criminal.
One thing I want to refer back to in our previous little discussion, he said, ignoring the previous statement.
Right.
Is that just because there's someone who's giving a presentation doesn't necessarily mean that there's any actual evidence to back that up. I am highly skeptical of a presentation happening in Russia, in Russian, to Russian audiences, blaming United States intelligence agencies for the creation of cryptocurrencies, or at least the use of cryptocurrencies to fund black ops operations, because there may be, and I hesitate to say this, but there may be a bias.
What? There. Yeah, I'm really glad you made that point, because one thing that happens, too, depending on people's ideological viewpoints, is we will sometimes tend to pick on one organization over another that would do essentially the same thing.
Sure.
So it's a real tall milkshake to say that one intelligence agency did something and the other intelligence agencies, A, did not know about it, or B, did know about it and also didn't try to do something like it.
Or C, yeah, wasn't already doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
Like it is not a stretch of the imagination to think that, like I said before, I would not be shocked to find out that there had been use of cryptocurrencies for these sort of black ops operations because by their very nature, everything is trying to avoid detection in the from the get-go. But I also would not be shocked to hear that, say, the KGB had used cryptocurrencies to pay, I don't know, hackers in North Korea.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's no way that's not happening.
At least a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, man. Like, it just seems rife for that kind of stuff. And, like, you know, that's what these black ops are all about, is that kind of freewheeling attitude where it's just, like, improvising and figuring out different ways to do things. And, you know, it's all about being up on the latest technology. And I don't know. It just seems... It rings true,
I mean,
for me.
Yeah. If they want to use the cryptocurrency spy cred, that would probably be a getaway.
Here's another aspect of this that I think argues in favor of this behavior. It's that we're now, as a species and as a conglomeration of state actors, seeing a fundamental transformation in the nature of warfare, right? We know that there is a ticking time limit to the usefulness or efficacy of cruise ships, right? We know that for several decades, with great success, countries that would not normally be able to fight in a conventional war have successfully funneled time, blood, sweat, and tears, and plenty of R&D into asymmetrical warfare, which is why we see, you know, so-called hacker or bot armies influencing opinion through soft power stuff like propaganda. The new war, or the new theater of war, people at the Pentagon are always saying, is informational, right?
Well, I mean, you've already seen, over the past decade, we've seen numerous examples here in the United States of foreign actors who have infiltrated various information systems.
Oh, like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's more of an overt one, but I was thinking of things like in the electric grid, the power grid. Mm-hmm. There have been numerous occasions where security experts have looked at the different systems and various major power companies and throughout the power grid in the United States and said, there's evidence here of foreign hackers putting in code to help infiltrate the infrastructure. To what purpose? Who's to say? But it's not a stretch to imagine that these are all kind of little trigger points that should someone want to do serious damage to the United States, you flip a switch and you overload a power grid. You make it so that it is going beyond its capabilities. You know, you could actually physically snap power cables if you're sending enough juice through. You get to a point like that, you cripple the infrastructure, and it creates enough chaos for you to get away with other stuff if you need to. So there's entirely that possibility. Now, the fact that nothing like that has actually happened, we haven't seen any, you know, rolling blackouts due to this, means that whatever they were trying to do, they had not actually, you know, they hadn't actually pulled that switch, but they had started to lay the groundwork. Well, that stuff's happening all the time everywhere. The United States, you know, obviously we're focused on it because we live here, but it's happening all over the world from various actors all working at cross purposes against each other. And
sort of an ensemble cast.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've got things like Stuxnet, which certainly seems to have the United States fingerprints on it. It would be hard to deny that based upon the code that was used in it.
Give us a little bit of a rundown on
Stuxnet.
I'm not 100%.
So Stuxnet was a virus specifically. All right.
Is
a virus. So nuclear power plants. One of the things they have are centrifuges that spin at a certain RPMs, right? And they spin at that certain RPMs because if you spin too slowly or too quickly, then things go wrong. And Stuxnet, effectively what it did was it made the centrifuges turn at a speed that was wrong, too fast for what it was supposed to do. The idea being that it would cause failures in Iran's nuclear power capabilities. And it kind of worked. It's tough to do because these facilities mostly have air gaps. Air gaps are where you do not have a connection between your internal system and an external system. So it meant that you had to get physical access to the location.
In the form of a thumb drive.
You could do a thumb drive, yeah. Just do a thumb drive. And even if you're just doing a thumb drive where you're sending it to, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to have been someone on the inside who was compromised. You could send a thumb drive to let's say, the person at the front desk and say, there's a new update to the operating system. Just plug this in and that'll do it. And then it could infect the internal network, which could then go and affect whatever systems you need to compromise.
But you wouldn't have, like, remote control over it.
No.
It would just
have
instructions that it would, like,
it's good
relay.
Good old coding. You're just writing in the code, like, when this happens, execute this line of code. So it's in some ways it's really sophisticated. In other ways, it's very basic.
But it's brilliant in the simplicity of application, but there's a lot of very elegant code going in there.
Yeah, and the code, yes, it was definitely advanced. And so that the people argue because of the advanced nature of the code, it narrows down the suspect list of who could have done it. And because of the very nature of the code itself, a lot of people have said, this looks an awful lot like stuff that comes out of the United States, maybe.
And also Israel.
They
say Israel and the U.S. work together
on
stuff.
That's the common thread, yeah. So, and, you know, of course, no one's going to come forward and say, you got us. It was us. But it does definitely seem to point that way. Now, does that mean that it's definitely U.S. and Israel? Well, I mean, we can't speak in certainties, but it seems fairly fairly sure. Like, it's hard to deny it. Now, in that world where we've got all these different parties working at cross purposes, infiltrating different systems, plausible deniability, very important, right? Like, we're seeing it through everything from the accusations of interfering with election cycles to to affecting entire systems, you know, and the usual suspects that pop up for things that are happening in the United States are Russia, North Korea, and China. Those are your three big ones. So you could, you know, and then of course you've got the states saying it's not us. We didn't authorize this. If you use something like a cryptocurrency to pay the people who are actually creating the code and executing the code and overseeing the botnets and actually doing the work, then you've got that level of plausible deniability. You don't know who paid whom. It could be that you have an outside organization, mm-hmm. someone who's not even remotely connected to the governments of those countries. They say, let's just make use of them because, one, they have the technology. Two, they have the education and know-how on how to do it. And three, it takes all the heat off us because they'll never know it was
us. We're as surprised as you are.
Yeah, we just paid those guys, and we paid them with a type of currency that can't be traced back to us.
We're basically watching The Sixth Sense with you for the first time.
All we're doing is putting on all of those graphics processing units to work.
It's really interesting. Yeah, it's really interesting you say this because one of the controversial practices in China that the governments of the United States and China disagree on is who's paying documented Chinese hacking forces.
Yeah.
Because they're not government employees. And the Chinese position for some time has been this is just a group of idealistic, very nationalistic people.
These are people who identify with China's philosophies. But they are not in any way sponsored by or endorsed by the government. For example, when Sony had their massive data breach where gigabytes of data, like, mostly in the form of movies, but lots of other stuff too, including like records of executives and actors and all this other stuff that got leaked out, there were a couple of different arguments about where that came from. One was the possibility of it being from North Korean hackers because mm-hmm. it was in response to a film that was coming out that was
The Interview.
Yeah, it was The Interview. It was a little bit of a spoof on North Korea's leader, and North Korea had condemned it. So there was argument like, well, clearly you had already said that, you know, you objected strongly to the movie. Apparently you objected strongly enough to fund hackers to attack this company, this global company.
Apparently, the movie wasn't even very good.
It's not that good. I've seen it.
It was fine.
We did an episode on this that you appeared on, John. Yeah. Do you remember that? This idea of sophisticated coding and the separation of the true actor from the appearance of an actor leads us to another very strange question. So far, when we've been talking about hidden hands behind cryptocurrency,
sure.
We've been talking about humans.
Well, what are we going to talk about? Raccoons?
Yes. Badgers.
We don't need robot any badgers. Stinking badgers. Oh, robo-badgers.
What if?
Uh-huh.
What if?
Okay.
Hear me out.
Yeah, hit me.
What if a rogue artificial intelligence created Bitcoin for the express purpose of siphoning electricity to feed its nefarious dark engines?
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
It eats electricity?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Well, I mean, if it's an artificial intelligence, it's presumably running on silicon-based hardware and thus needs electricity to run. So electricity would mean power. Power is what allows it to process information. It needs a lot of it.
Can you see the veins?
I'm trying so hard to not just call nonsense on this. But
here. Let's also use this as an opportunity to talk about how much bloody power and energy that mining for Bitcoin consumes. I think this is a good jumping off
point. Yeah.
Well, and I mentioned in the previous episode, so when you're mining Bitcoins, what you're really doing is you're trying to solve very difficult mathematical problems in order to validate past transactions, the ones that have just happened, to add the next block to the blockchain. And if you manage to do that, you get rewarded not just with whatever coins are mined at that time,
sure,
which is predetermined. And every few years, the number halves per block that
I think
is mined.
Currently, Bitcoin miners generate around 75 Bitcoins per hour.
And when you look at that by per block, it breaks down even further, obviously, because it's every 10 minutes is another block, right?
Right.
So But every few years, that number is cut in half until you finally get to the point where all Bitcoins that will ever exist are in the system. And at that point, it's just transaction fees that keep things going.
While energy spent on mining Bitcoins is increasing.
Well, to a point.
To a point.
So if you get to a point where the number of Bitcoins you get per transaction completed is small enough, then you have to reconcile that with how much money you are spending on the electricity being used for the processing power. And if you're spending more money on electricity than you're making money in the Bitcoins you're mining, that's a losing proposition and people are going to start to back off.
Here's the thing, though. According to an article on Motherboard, right now with the trajectory of Bitcoin value being what it is, they say it would be profitable for miners on the whole to burn through more than 24 terawatt hours of electricity in a year's time.
Sure. Yeah. And but these are making lots of assumptions. Assumption number one is that the value of Bitcoin is going to continue to be high enough for that to be true. And we don't necessarily know that. I suspect it is going to be true. But over time, that is, by the nature of what Bitcoin is, going to decrease. It has to, because that's just how, unless Bitcoin's value just continuously skyrockets and just keeps on building and never takes enough of a backtrack to settle back down to whatever, like $10,000 per Bitcoin, which is still a huge amount, no doubt about it, then you do eventually get to a point where you're getting a decimal, like 10,000th of a Bitcoin when you successfully mine a block. It doesn't make sense for you to continuously use that much power because you will be spending more money than you get. That's down the road, though, because it's when you've gone a few years where this number keeps halving until it gets down to this tiny, tiny number. But eventually you get to a point where it won't make sense to spend that much electricity. In the short term, however, you're seeing massive amounts of electricity being used to mine these coins.
That number I said is apparently about the amount of energy that Nigeria uses in a year, and that's a country of 186 million people.
Yeah, and it's not a surprise, but what will happen is you'll eventually, or at least the idea, is that you'll eventually reach a peak, you know, peak Bitcoin, where assuming the value of the Bitcoin doesn't skyrocket again, that more and more people will start to back off. And once they back off, the difficulty of that problem will decrease, and people who are running more modest hardware will be able to mine Bitcoins. And it won't be as big of a yield per block mined, but at the same time, they're also not the ones who would otherwise be spending thousands of dollars just on electricity bills.
Until the machine consciousness is sated, at which point there would be no reason to continue this charade.
Right. I find it very difficult to believe that an artificial intelligence is, in fact, responsible for this. But I will support that argument after you take a break to thank your sponsors.
How could you?
Whoa!
Such cheek, Jonathan.
I am cheeky.
The sand.
Sorry, guys. I saw an opportunity and I went for it. So I said that I was going to support my argument. So the biggest argument I would make is just that artificial intelligence is nowhere near the level of sophistication necessary to create a system anywhere close to that complicated. I mean, I follow the bleeding edge of artificial intelligence. And there's some amazing stuff in machine learning. There's amazing stuff in various aspects of intelligence, but they're all very, very narrow applications. So, for example, image recognition. We're getting really good at that. Voice recognition. We're getting really good at it. But these are all just tiny little slivers of intelligence. When it comes to innovation, we're really lagging behind as far as machine intelligence is concerned. And an example of this is if you ever try and use the tool Chef Watson. Chef Watson uses the same platform as Watson that went on Jeopardy and won at Jeopardy, right? And the way it works is that it was fed a whole bunch of different recipe books. And then it takes all that information and it starts to really analyze it and try to figure out which cooking techniques go with which ingredients complement one another based upon their appearance in various recipes. And then what you do is you tell it what kind of stuff you have at your disposal, and it suggests recipes for you to cook. And they're bonkers crazy.
What's an example?
So, for example, there's cauliflower fricassee. One of the optional ingredients in cauliflower fricassee is cauliflower. I'm serious. Like, I'm going through the list of recipes, and there's this cauliflower. Optional. I'm like, so...
Burning question. Yeah. I've always wondered what constitutes a fricassee.
You know, an excellent question that I am not prepared to answer, but I will tell you this, that Chef Watson it's dynamically creating these recipes. So if you were to put the exact same recipes in or exact same ingredients in as I did, you would get a different recipe. If I did it twice in a row, I would get two different recipes. And they would be recipes that were created on the spot at that moment, not like stored in some database and then retrieved. So it's not like search results.
Just goes to show that Watson has moods, man.
My point being that Watson hasn't quite nailed it yet.
Sure.
This is about cooking a meal that is edible to human beings. Creating an entire cryptocurrency system in order to mask the consumption of energy is an order of magnitude more complicated. And I just cannot conceive of that being in the realm of possibility.
Well, of course not, man. You have a meat brain.
Yeah, maybe that's the problem.
What if Satoshi Nakamoto is working with the machines, is aiding the machines in this endeavor because he wants to be the number one meat bag when the takeover happens?
He doesn't want to get caught in that Skynet.
Right.
Da-da-da-da-da.
It's made of lasers.
Yeah.
We're doing references today, folks.
Sorry, you invited me on the show.
I knew. What happens. We knew what we were getting into, and we welcome it.
I think this is a fascinating idea. The idea that there could, to me, this is on the same level as someone who suggested, and I mentioned this in our previous episode too, someone who suggested that the reason why the Large Hadron Collider suffered so many setbacks early on when it was first going to come online was that supposedly someone from the future, some entity from the future, was traveling back in time to sabotage the Large Hadron Collider because once it turned on, it would cause some sort of calamitous event that would perhaps extinguish the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were – whether those were theories that were expressed in jest or seriously, I don't know. I mean, they seem tongue-in-cheek to me, but I can never tell if someone's being serious or not, which is why I am so awful whenever I go to stand-up. But the fact that those were put forward, it seems very similar to this kind of suggestion. And while it's fun to think about, and I certainly think it's a great premise for like a science fiction story, it's just not quite within the scope of what we're capable of doing right now.
What do you think, Matt?
I think it's just hiding.
You just think the artificial intelligence is hiding?
Yeah. What it's like, look at all this energy usage. I'm not in here. I'm not inside.
To what end?
Well, it's hiding till one day we get all of those slivers that we're talking about of innovation into one unique piece of just what it means to be a human. Then it will know, and then it will become.
I think any artificial intelligence of that sophistication would be able to essentially and would have already infected all networks and distributed itself to a point where we are already superfluous. And why did the lights just flicker? Okay, well, never mind. You know, I'm just gonna drop off. I'm gonna drop off on that line of logic right now.
I'll tell you the problem there, though, is inherently artificial intelligences don't have hands, what with to build stuff, right? So they need us for a time, and then, you know, it's lights out.
Until robots are better. When they get better robots.
That's what I'm saying. The robots these days, I mean, they're hard-pressed to, like, you know, walk across the room. They're a little clunky.
That's, again, why I sit there and say that our ability to create an artificial intelligence of sophistication that would be able to do this is kind of laughable, because we're still at a point where a robot that is designed to learn how to open doors will sit and stare at a door for 6 hours
and then reach out
and pull a door that's meant to be pushed.
It might have a different handle.
I do that all the time.
Yeah, I literally ran into a door yesterday.
No, I also don't expect you to create a cryptocurrency to hide how much power you are consuming.
Hey, I make no secret about my consumption. Yeah.
And don't sell them short. We've looked at three of the really big ideas, right? That somehow on this idea of artificial intelligence or machine consciousness, maybe there isn't some sort of proto Skynet entity out there, but would you be as quick to dismiss the idea of, you know, the idea of some of the same lessons learned from high frequency trading or algorithm studies? Like, I know Bitcoin mining is using algorithms.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that certainly people are using artificial intelligence in order to work with Bitcoin, but I don't think Bitcoin itself is a product or is being manipulated that on that grand a scale by artificial intelligence. But yes, as you mentioned, high frequency trading, that's where you've got computer algorithms that are making thousands of trades per second, really, far faster than what any human can do. And you end up seeing little mini crashes and bubbles in the stock market as a result.
I can't believe we almost forgot. In the first episode, we left off at the very end with something we need to get to, even if it's just at the end of this episode. Whales.
Oh, so yeah, I'm happy to talk about whales, because we, you know, you guys were talking about different questions to ask. And one of the questions you had was, could there possibly be any entity or organization that could really work to leverage Bitcoins in some way that could be harmful to others? That leads us to the discussion of whales. What are whales? Why do we call them whales? Whales, that's a term within the Bitcoin sphere for organizations or people who own a large number of Bitcoins. And it is estimated, Bloomberg did a piece on this in 2017, that 1,000 people own 40% of all the Bitcoins out there.
Wow. There's already economic inequality.
Yeah.
And like,
so you think about that, 40%, nearly half of all Bitcoins belong to just 1,000 people. So keeping that in mind, and remember, Bitcoin, I argue it's not really effective as a currency. It's more like a commodity in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that you've got these 1,000 people, and through their circles, they just have learned, even if it's only a portion of them, learn who the others are.
Okay.
Right? So it's a loose confederation of Bitcoin owners. And they all watch very carefully as the value of Bitcoin climbs. And they're thinking, all right, I feel like at, let's say, $17,000, that's going to be the peak before we hit the next plateau or maybe even a drop-off. What we're going to do collectively so that we can really cash in is we're all agreeing at X amount of time, we're all going to liquefy our Bitcoins so that we can maximize our profit and then get out before the crash, which means that they would actually be causing a crash because they'd be dumping thousands, hundreds of thousands of Bitcoins on the market simultaneously, which would devalue it. Suddenly the demand would be far lower than the supply, right? It's typically the other way around. And you could see an entire market collapse. This is the same sort of concept as someone who's dealing with insider trading, right? That they have the foreknowledge that something big is going to happen, and they either buy up a lot of stock or sell off a lot of stock before the announcement hits so that they can maximize their profit from it. That's the fear. that this 1,000 people who own almost half of all the Bitcoins,
which is about $74 billion.
Yeah, $74 billion worth, could collectively make the decision to get out of the game and maximize their profits. Because, I mean, you know, they could just convert it to whatever currency they wanted to.
Because, I mean, surely they're in some kind of underground, like, torture club together, right?
Yeah, there's probably a fight club, probably a Bitcoin fight club.
I'm just saying, like, you'd think players of that level, as anonymous as it all is, are more likely to be aware of each other than, say, some of the smaller players.
Well, there's certainly, like, there are online discussion groups about Bitcoin where people who adopted it early certainly know each other, or at least know each other by handle, if not by name.
You got to think there's some younger people, much younger than you would imagine,
sure,
being old enough to have that much money.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially for the early days, again, before the computing demands got so high because the computational problems got so complicated. And obviously, if you got in on the ground floor and you were constantly using at least some of your Bitcoins to help supply the need for more advanced computing equipment, you could just continuously build out your mining rig to mine more. So as long as you're mining more coins than you're spending on your mining rig, you're in the winning situation, right? Well, if this group of people all decided that they were going to do that, it could be a total catastrophe for the currency as a whole. And there have been some folks who have said that Bitcoin is in a bubble and that bubble's going to burst. And one of the things that could cause that is a tacit agreement among the whales to get out of the game rather than watch their investment balloon up in value and then deflate and then balloon up and deflate. I mean, I can't imagine what that would do to me. Like, if I were sitting there looking at my digital wallet and thinking, all right, I've got 20 Bitcoins. And wow, today it's $200,000. And then the next day, like, now it's down to $20,000. I lost 80 grand overnight. Like, it would drive me crazy. So that is a real fear. Whether or not it would ever happen is it's still a hypothetical. It's not like it's actually happened, but it's still a possibility.
Supposedly, there's a lot of work being done with neural networks being used to predict the change in Bitcoin price.
Yeah. And honestly, now we're getting to a level of technology that is, I mean, it's fascinating to me. Neural networks are amazing. I love neural networks. But you're getting to a point where you're taking technology, which is something I understand pretty well, and you're applying it to market theory, which is something that is like witchcraft to me.
Even to the experts, it's like witchcraft.
Yeah.
I mean, you have these like high-level economists who just completely contradict each other all the time.
It makes me feel like string theory.
Yeah.
Because you talk to someone who's an expert in string theory and you say, you keep asking questions, you will eventually get to a question where they say like, yeah, the math tells me what it is, but I don't understand it.
That's the thing. When you're at the bleeding edge of something, to use the phrase you had established earlier, when you're at that edge, people are guessing, and it becomes very close to ideology. There are economists that have clearly been demonstrably wrong over decades.
Yeah.
And they're sticking to the model.
And the nature of an edge is that it's not that hard to fall off.
That's
there we
true.
Go.
That's yeah. true. It's really, I like that. I want it on a bumper sticker.
So, you know, just really fast, something that I didn't understand before we did this episode is that exactly how many cryptocurrencies exist. And I know we keep saying that there are a lot of them. Did you guys mention how many
All I did was just mention a few. But
we named a few.
Okay, so according to CoinMarketCap.com, which tracks all of them, and it gives you their market cap, it gives you the price of a single one, the volume, the circulating supply. It's really interesting. It gives you a change over time for a 24-hour period. You can get really deep into it if you want to, the way you would a stock market, just a currency exchange. It has almost 1,500 different currencies that are out there right now. That's insane to me. I've only ever been aware of four, I think.
Right, like Ethereum and Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There are that many, and if you look through this list on this website, it's so much money just wrapped up in these ethereal things.
It's so much wealth.
Read those white papers, Matt. Sign up.
That's my thing, though. What makes one more attractive than another? Is it just that it has a cooler name? Like, I don't understand.
I mean, it's honestly, when you really boil it down, it's the ones that people feel are valuable.
Consensual delusion.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing as really any currency. Like, if we go way back in time where we get to bartering, then we can have little philosophical discussions. Like, Ben, really, do you think that this laptop I have is worth only two chickens? I don't care how close you are to your chickens. I'm going to need more than two chickens for this laptop.
He's very close.
You don't even know their names, man. How dare you?
Yeah, do you know my laptop's name?
Yes.
Dell.
It's actually Lappy.
Oh.
I named him after Strong Bad's laptop. But no, it's...
Yeah, it's a good point.
But we could, you know, that gets to a point where you argue, all right, well, how much is the thing that you make worth the thing that I make? Because I need what you have and you need what I have. And then the problem that came in is when, let's say that I need a table and the carpenter, Noel, you're the carpenter.
Okay.
I'm going to go to you and I'm like, I need a table. I'm a goat farmer. I can give you goat milk. And you're like, dude, I do not like goat's milk. Well, now I have to either find someone else who makes something you do need, trade the goat's milk for the thing that you like, Noel, and then bring that to you. And then get my table, or we have to invent a currency because this is just too crazy. I need some other means of transaction.
Let's just start a cult. This already sounds like a lot of work.
Money is, dude. It really is. It's what money is.
Yes.
And just last thing, there right now in all these different cryptocurrencies, there is over $500 billion circulating in this just somewhat vaporware of money.
Yeah. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but seriously, when you really look at all currencies, you realize that there's only like a half step of difference between the quote unquote real currencies of like dollars and pounds and euros and things like that, and digital currencies. It seems like there's more because you can hold things, you know, most of them have physical versions of them, like dollars. You can get a dollar bill. And since you hold it in your hand, it has permanence and you think of it as being a real thing. But when you really, really look beyond that, you realize, wow, we're all just pretending. And as long as everyone keeps pretending, everything's fine. But if we ever come to a day where we decide to stop pretending, we're boned.
We're all Elmer Fudd,
yeah,
or Daffy Duck walking off the cliff right before they looked down.
As long as you don't look down, you don't fall.
Well, but if you think about it, though, too, if you really want to go down that rabbit hole, it's like the reality that we all accept comes with kind of being part of a police state. Because as soon as you step outside of your lane and say, I don't accept this anymore, or I want more, I should have this much money, I'm going to take it, you get shot or you get put in jail. Like, there are very real boundaries that force us to be a part of this system and accept it. So it's a lot easier to accept it knowing that if you don't, you're boned too. So it's kind of a boned if you do, boned if you don't.
Yeah, what it comes down to is our confidence in the method of transaction. And if our confidence is sound, it doesn't really matter what we call it or whether it's digital or physical. If we're confident in it that the thing that I have in my hand will be able to purchase the goods or services that I want, and then tomorrow it's just as good, and the next day and the next, we're fine. It's when you sit there and say, this thing we've all been pretending has value, I just realized it doesn't, and now everyone else has realized that, and then suddenly the value just disappears because we've gotten rid of our shared delusion.
We did an episode asking whether money is a religion, and one of the things we always took away from that and found interesting was that, you know, there's a reason genres of some religions and versions of some currencies are referred to as denominations.
Yeah.
It's not for nothing does etymology exist.
Also remember, it's not money that's the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil.
All right. Well, we have like three emotions a year, so you don't need to worry about that.
No, speak for yourself, buddy.
I found two currencies that are tracked on here.
Yeah.
The first one is called Snake Eyes.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And it just goes by the handle Snake. So I got like 20 snake, man. I think that's awesome. That needs to catch on right now. It's like worthless. So we need to get that back up.
I just see thousands of snakes wearing eye patches. Go ahead.
And this one, it's gay money. That's what it says. So, you know, maybe
more power.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if there's 1,500 of these, then I see no reason why we can't get Ben Bucks on the board.
Oh, right? Man. Thank you so much.
Right? Let's end with that. How do you do it? How do we go from Ben Bucks, the notion, to BenBucks, the publicly traded, tradable, available cryptocurrency.
We do have tangible BenBucks, by the way.
Well,
glad to make the switch.
You definitely don't need tangible ones. So what you would need to do is you would have to set up a network. You would have to create the software that would allow you to create the blocks of transactions, just as Bitcoin and all these other cryptocurrencies use. So you would have this technology where it would be proprietary to BenBucks, where the method we use to create the math problem that the various computers on the network have to solve in order to verify transactions is unique, and one that we could scale up or scale down.
We can't trade snake eyes for BenBucks.
You could, actually. That's why exchanges exist, right? The exchange's purpose is to determine what is the relative value of all these different currencies so that you can make those exchanges. Although all it really means is that you're handing the units of BenBucks over to the exchange. The exchange hands units of equivalent for snake eyes to you, and then the exchange has your BenBucks.
So this is totally possible.
It's possible. It would be, do we have any computers in the office that aren't currently being used for anything?
I hope those words taste good when you eat them later.
Because I'm just saying, I mean, I got a gaming rig, which means that I can be like the number one miner of BenBucks, which means I can be.
You'd be getting in on the ground floor.
We're taking all our old gaming consoles, pulling a Pentagon and networking them together.
Remember when the
Pentagon brought, like, or DOD, excuse me, got like
PS2s.
Yeah.
It was the old
like
PS2s. 300
something.
PS2 I can contribute.
I have one too.
The thing was that Sony eventually made a change in the firmware that removed the ability to boot into Linux using PS2s. But they were actually being used as supercomputers when they were networked together by the U.S. government and others. It was pretty cool.
We could flash firmware or something, right?
Yeah.
I think they might have finally lifted it. Honestly, I haven't kept up because PS2s are so 20 years ago?
So,
am I that old?
So let's put an air gap in this conversation
for now.
Thank you again so much for coming on the show and walking us through crypto conspiracies, Jonathan.
No, thank you so much for having me. I am now going to go home, look at my paycheck, and wonder what is happening.
I think we're all going to do that.
You're all going to look at my paycheck? That's totally against company policy.
You get a check? Weird.
I just get snake eyes.
I just get a guy at my door saying, "You're good." And then he walks away.
It's called paying for protection, my man.
Is that the guy who touches your face when he talks to you?
No, he kisses
you on both cheeks.
I suspect that's Josh. He went from walking up behind me and inhaling deeply where he would take in my scent. This, by the way, totally not a joke. Josh Clark of Stuff You Should Know used to come behind me and sniff me.
Yep.
I think it might be him, but he just disguises his features. So it's just a guess at this point.
Speaking of fantastic segues, you can find Jonathan Strickland on Tech Stuff. You can check out his excellent work on YouTube, where he introduces you to concepts of everyday science and brain stuff, and where he gives you a much more optimistic look at the future than we do in his video series, Forward Thinking.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts on everything we've discussed today and in the previous episode, please write to us, talk to us on social media. We are Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us on Instagram at Conspiracy Stuff Show. And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, just send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.